Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also broadcast on A2Zen.fm, Sundays at 3 p.m., and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show page. And today we have got, I think, an extraordinary story to tell. It's a new story. It's an old story. It's kind of both. And we're going to have some fun with this program today. But I want to remind you that all of our programs are archived on the richarddugan.com radio shows page. And we link to our guests' websites when they have them. And 99.9% of the time they do. We will provide some information one way or the other. And also, if you'd like to help to support this program as we move forward in time, be a part of the work that we're doing, go to the missions page, read what our mission is all about. And if you'd like to support that, we are more than grateful for that through PayPal or through GoFundMe, I believe is the name of the website, all secure and all that good stuff. But we'll also take energetic support as well. This program is designed to bring you new paradigms, new ideas, new thoughts, looking for those new ways of living. And I have to say that up to the point of this interview, I have been struck by some incredible, incredible things that over the course of time I will tell you about. But the most incredible one at this particular point happens to be the telling of what could be considered an old story in a new way. It's a new story as well. And that's really one of the things that many of our listeners, and we've had storytellers on this program before, people, that's what their job is, their work is, their vocation is to tell stories. And today is no different. We have on the line with us, he's an author. His name is David Christopher. He's the author of The Holy Universe. It's a new story of creation for the heart, soul, and spirit. And I am I'm really excited about this particular program, David, and thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, and thank you for inviting me to be on your program. I very much appreciate it.
You've done something that a lot of people have done, and that is you have said bye-bye to the workaday world, so to speak, those jobs that you had, and that's what they were in some manner of speaking, jobs, to pursue your life's purpose. You found it and said, hey, this is what I've got to be doing. And part of that is through this new work that you've put together called The Holy Universe. And I love the way that this is opening up. In particular, and I haven't been able to finish this particular chapter. I've skimmed through the book as well. The birthday story, which is spoken of in chapter one. And, of course, chapter one has to do with the meeting between the two main characters. One is the seeker and one is the sage. Now, I'm not going to give anything away in regards to that first chapter in terms of what we've discussed. But what I am going to say is that I found myself identifying maybe too closely with the seeker to the point where, and I was reading this out loud to my wife, and that's one of the things that we've been doing is we've been reading your book. I read it to her, and you know, we read it together. And I was so taken by his level of frustration or feeling of disconnectedness or feeling of being lost and so forth. There are, should I say, millions of people who feel that way today, and they haven't lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Certainly millions, if not, well, I don't know. Billions might be a stretch, but certainly millions. Yes. Yeah.
So you left two careers, basically. You mm-hmm. basically said that I'm done. I'm bringing this chapter of my life to an end, mm-hmm. and I'm going to start a new chapter here. How did that transpire? What was the catalyst, or let's just say, what was the milestone that you can recall where that process began, that led you to cross that road, if you will, cross that bridge, and then in many aspects, maybe even burned the bridge behind you so that you couldn't go back.
Right. Yes. Yes. Oh, there were a couple of incidences. I do remember one particular incident when I was pulling into the parking lot of my Silicon Valley job and just suddenly had this feeling of, I can't do this anymore. I was essentially helping to sell software. And for whatever reason, not that that's bad in of itself, but it just certainly, all of the lifestyle that goes with it, goes with that Silicon Valley lifestyle, just was not making my heart sing. And a few months later, I was actually in the workout, the gym that the company set up for its employees. And a lot of companies do that. And I remember reading a particular book by a man named Jerry Mander, and it was called In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indigenous Nations. I think I got that subtitle right. But I was reading that on the Stairmaster, and there was a particular point in that book where it talked about how what the sage actually calls modern mind is just destroying. The biosphere is running over indigenous peoples, and that was the second and really the final hit of, I've got to stop this. I can't do this anymore. I did actually go back to aviation for a while. I was a flight instructor for a long time, but there was a certain point where I realized I can't do this anymore because I need something to really feed my heart, my soul, and my spirit. And so I just wandered for a bit. And I'm sure of those millions of people that you referred to earlier, a lot of them you end up wandering. And I realized at a certain point, and this is a number of years later, that, and I can tell you more about that particular incident, that I realized that, oh, it's not necessarily me that's the problem. I'm not the one, I'm not able to fit into this paradigm, into this worldview. Because this worldview is actually, on the face of it, insane. It is tearing up the planet. No wonder you feel out of place. Anyone who is really, I think, anyone who is really paying attention to what modern mind is doing to, you know, our ecology, that is doing to its peoples, and even doing to our spirituality, is going to realize at a certain point that it's destructive. It's become a destructive presence. Not to say that modern mind hasn't given us many wonderful things, which it has. I mean, it is technologically brilliant, but that's not enough. The technological brilliance all by itself, without a sense of sacredness of the planet that essentially provides everything we need, is a recipe for disaster. And I think that's a lot of that's certainly what drove me into the direction of my path. And I wouldn't be surprised if people have similar stories too.
Let's talk a little bit about the sacredness, okay? Not just of the modern mind, but also, especially in light of the title of your book, The Holy Universe, and you could replace the word holy with sacred as well. What is it that compelled you to look at it from that standpoint? I mean, certainly we could, from the farthest distance away, view the universe in that way and say, oh yes, it's holy and it's quiet and it's calm and it's serene and the stars glitter and so forth and so on. And there is no real activity that we can perceive, you know, from this distance. But obviously when you take the microscope and focus it down on any of the large cities, even the small towns and so forth, you see the hustle, the bustle, you see what some might even consider the chaos, if you will. So how did you come to understand that there was a holiness or sacredness about the universe, of which, of course, we are also a part?
Well, that your question offers some of the answer. We are part of this universe. And the new story, just to give your listeners a little bit of context, the new story that the sage and the seeker talk about is this story of the universe from the very beginning, what the sage calls the beginning of all beginnings. And then the evolution of galaxies and stars and planets and life, and then the web of life here on Earth. And the story really grounds us into some reality that when you lift yourself out of that day-to-day, I don't know if chaos is the right word, because chaos actually has some wonderful scientific and mysterious roles to play. But the day-to-day franticness, or franticness is quite a word, but the frantic way in which we go about our lives disconnects us from that everyday knowledge of that we are part of this universe. One of the stories that modern mind tells is the story of separation, that we are separate from each other, we are separate from the web of life, we can do whatever we want to the web of life without consequence. We're even separate from the cosmos. And early on, 10,000 years as modern mind emerged from what the sage calls ancient mind, when we started getting serious about agriculture, that's when our stories of separation really began to take hold. And then we developed agricultural villages, cities, agricultural civilizations. And throughout that, the underlying story through nearly all those worldviews was a story of separation. And it really got going when, say, 300 to 500 years ago, during the European Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and when science really started getting hold of our worldviews and even took away the gods. That, yes, the story of separation early on had a sense of sacredness in terms of reconciling with God, reconciling that separation. And then we came up with a story that the universe is dead. And in fact, at one point, the story of modern mind, I've got to actually see if I can flip to it. It says, and starts in a very, in a way that tells us that the universe is dead. The Earth is only an insignificant rock spinning off into a lifeless cosmos. Humanity is a mere accident. Indeed, all of life is a vacuous accident. And while the universe somehow creates many fantastic things, and humanity is the pinnacle of this improbable process, humanity must struggle. For humanity is ultimately alone in and alienated from and must find its lonely stumbling way through a decaying and meaningless universe. And that really is the story that was given to us, that emerged a few hundred years ago. One of my friends who was, he became a physicist, and when he read, he was one of the readers for the manuscript, and when he read that particular piece, he made a comment saying, "This is exactly what I was taught in school when I was studying science." And the thing was, is that I was never taught that directly, but all the sciences permeated through that. So this is a very long answer to your question. The reason why I wanted to bring in that term holy, because it's also related to holistic, to the whole, that seeing the universe as a whole, with all its chaotic things and all its chaos, all its order, it's all part of one amazing, fantastic, violent, and creative and destructive process.
We've had guests on this program before who have spoken of civilizations that existed prior to ours. And I don't necessarily mean in the last 200, 300 years. I'm talking 10, 20, 30, 50, 100, 1,000 years ago on this planet. There's evidence that has been spoken of on this program to support the existence of humans on this planet, and they unfortunately didn't learn these kinds of lessons and annihilated themselves. I'm wondering what you might know about that, but in light of a question that I have put recently to our guests, when we get into these kinds of conversations of our civilization and society and what we're doing, I mean, I've even observed that I actually think that our way of life is in spite of the fact that there are 7 billion of us on the planet, we are an endangered species because our lifestyle, especially in the West, is not only killing us, but by virtue of us spreading it like a virus across the oceans and to other lands who never knew of this way of life, we're killing them too.
Mm-hmm.
So the question has come up, why is it important for man to continue? And let me preface that by our postscript that by saying, I'm not advocating annihilation.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying we draw a line in the sand saying, on this date, there will be no more babies conceived. This is the end of the race of man because we haven't learned a thing, and there's no reason for us to continue on because we're not doing anything different that we haven't been doing for hundreds of years. And that could be the observation of a pessimist, but that would be that's where that question sort of comes from. It's like our systems. There are people who just want to keep them going, these institutions, the economic and religious and educational systems that aren't working.
Well, and the institutions themselves are actually out of control.
Well, absolutely.
Even if the board of directors of a major corporation wanted to do the right things, the larger system, the larger worldview insists that, no, your first law, your first rule, your first commitment is toward making money.
Yeah.
And that is how our corporate structures have evolved over time. Wasn't necessarily always that way,
mm-hmm.
but it has certainly become that way. So, why should man continue? We are starting to change. And I actually realized too that I have to stop myself too when I say the word man and I stop and say, wait a minute, no, humanity. And that my proclivity of saying of using the word man to refer to all of humanity may be part of the problem because we're only seeing half of the population when we say that, or we're only including that.
Okay.
So in that, I'm wondering if that's part of our waking up is realizing that, we have ignored half of our population. This is one facet of what we've learned. But there are a lot of people who are waking up. Whether or not there's a wonderful quote, I don't know if I could quite remember it. I think it was E.F. Schumacher who said, you can either argue that, take the pessimist view and say, well, it's really too late and there's nothing we can do. Or we can take the optimist view saying, the universe knows what it's doing. So that invites the danger of complacency. And his feeling is, let's just get down to work and see what we can create from what we've created here and what we've been given.
Mm-hmm.
And the sage is very much of that ilk too, is that, I don't know whether or not humanity is destined to flower. Perhaps it is time for humanity to exit. And certainly with the sixth mass extinction that is already underway, we're on the list. We are definitely on that list. But it reminds me too of the section, part of the tale that the sage tells is how catastrophe can spur creativity.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that evolution does, is that it takes catastrophe and can create really amazing things.
Well, I know that one of the very early programs that we did back in 2007 with Barbara Marx Hubbard, she mm-hmm. spoke about a lot of these things taking place and what she referred to, you use the term catastrophe, she referred to as birth pangs.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. Certainly, I think, an apt analogy. And then there's the other aspect, too, in terms of I'm hoping that it's more and more of us within humanity are beginning to understand that the dualistic concept, and that's another story mm-hmm. that we have been taught from birth and passed down from generation to generation, is also an illusion. And that all of the great wisdom teachings say that mm-hmm. there is only that we're all part of the one. I mean, mm-hmm. We can say that, we as I was mentioning at the beginning there about, the universe and looking at it, and we're part of it too. And so that's where we're going back to. And I question, well, then what is the point of going through this crazy dualistic filter? I haven't been able to grasp the concept of the purpose of, if we were with the one, why would we have wanted to leave? And people tell me, well, it's for the experiences. And I think, well, but what is it that we would derive as the one from these experiences? What is so important that we needed to leave the, I'll call it the collective? Every time I think about this, I think of Star Trek's The Borg. And in spite of the fact that they were made out to be such vile, evil creatures, you know, mechanical, biological creatures, there was a certain element of collectiveness even within spirituality. You know, mm-hmm. when we talk about the still small voice, where is that voice coming from? It's coming from a central location. It's not giving each one of us exactly the same message. David Christopher has a different job to do than Richard Dugan. But yes, the jobs that you and I have to do, they work in concert with each other and others to accomplish the big picture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are fearful of that, and they'll label it as socialism, which, you know, we won't go into that. But the reality is that if we are walking our life's purpose, there is a certain element of the collective consciousness that is at work, or maybe I would love to say more at play, just enjoy this life, to have these experiences, I guess, is the only purpose that we're here for.
Well, and I think that, you know, as you were formulating your question of why are we even here, why would we, you know, when we figure that question out, that will be an amazing feat, because that's the question of the ages, is what is the purpose of life? Why are we here on this planet? What is this whole process? And one thing that I think, you know, a story that modern mind gets trapped into, especially the scientific, I don't mean to denigrate science, but we go too far in thinking that we have to unravel the mystery. We have to understand what the mystery is. Mm-hmm. And if we don't understand it, something is wrong. And there's a lot of power we got when we created language, you know, anywhere from 50 to 100,000 years ago, depending on which school of thought you adhere to. But, you know, language gives us so much power, but then it also took away the sense, it also served to create those ways of separating ourselves and telling stories and creating subject, object, verb, and starting to see the world in a different way. So we, you know, getting back to that original question, it's okay that it's a mystery. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, I was actually speaking to a college classroom once when they asked me, well, is there a God or is there not a God? And I gave them an answer that they really didn't like. And I said, I don't know. I don't know if I can know. And right now, I think that's okay. And they didn't like that. There was one who responded afterwards, said, well, he should just make up his mind. As if one could make up their mind about the ultimate mystery, and therefore it would become that way. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting study in moral and faith development, which was one of my many lifetimes ago I did study in my master's program. So I think part of what our task is to also allow ourselves to realize that we can't know everything. There's a large degree of humility that comes through the new story. And, you know, and really, for me, the new story really boils down to this, which is we belong here. We are not some kind of foreign entity that somehow, there's something wrong with us in that we don't belong here. You know, we are connected to the cosmos, and we are connected to one another, and we are connected to the web of life. And we're not fallen. We're not flawed. And even science is now agrees with what we've intuitively known along, that we are connected, very much connected in a web of actions as well as of, I'm sorry, a web of processes. And because we're connected, and this is where part of the new story that's very important that breaks away from the story of separation, our individual and collection action and collective actions have consequences. And our current story of separation is destructive. And until we adopt a new story of connection, we are going to have serious problems with our civilizations continuing and possibly even our species. As you alluded to earlier, we're in trouble if we continue this story of separation.
Absolutely, absolutely. When we come back, I want to go down a couple of paths. Number one, I want to go down the path that talks about the schools of thought as well as the philosophical as well as spiritual schools of thought that you have traversed. And then I also want to talk about the format of the book. This is Tell Me Your Story. We are talking with David Christopher. He's the author of, I think it's a neat book. I really do. And I don't say that very often in spite of the fact that all of our guests have incredible information and to share with us. And you're going to have to stay tuned to our next segment to find out why I think this is such a neat book. It's called The Holy Universe, A New Story of Creation for the Heart, Soul, and Spirit. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on these programs, taking the journey with us, and especially today with our guest, David Christopher, who's the author of The Holy Universe, A New Story of Creation for the Heart, Soul, and Spirit. And David, of course, you don't know this, but I grew up, I was born into this world legally blind and was that way basically until the age of 38 when I had a lens implant. And to that, I hated to read, especially in school and especially in the front of the class. But when I came across your book, the thing that I loved about it, and I actually mulled this over for a few moments, was I'm going to enjoy reading this book because it's laid out differently. As a matter of fact, if this book was laid out like all other books, it would be half its size. But you know what? That's okay. That's okay. And my wife and I have actually started to read this book together. We haven't done that in a long time. So yours is actually on the inaugural, the re-inauguration, if you will, of reading together out loud from, not from Kindle or some electronic media, but actually from a book that I have to hold in my hand. So I'm kind of excited about that. What made you decide, first of all, what is this format? And what made you decide on this format as opposed to left to right margins, top to bottom?
Well, the just to explain a little bit to your listeners, the format is such that the dialogue of the sage is on the left hand of the page, and the dialogue of the seeker is on the right hand of the page. And other characters that come out through the dialogues, too, are also on the left side of the page. So the seeker is on the right hand side, and the sage is on the left. And then the story text itself, it actually takes more of a poetic form. But the reason why I did this was almost a lark. I had been on an Outward Bound trip after my college years, right after graduation. And part of the task during our three-week trip was at some point we were to come up with a gift to give to the group. And some people made some very practical things. One person actually made a pot holder because holding hot pots was a big deal during the first week. And how do we get our food around to one another? And my gift was this little dialogue that just suddenly came to me as I was out on my solo trip when I was alone for 3 days. And I just started writing this. And this format just simply came out. There was something about the way the words were laid out that wanted to be in this way. And you know, being a former airline pilot, I tend to be kind of a skeptical kind of man. So I'm not, historically, I've been very leery about claims of channeling and whatnot, but I've become a lot less so ever since this whole creative process has more or less taken over my life. So that's where it started. And I sat on those words for many, 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 many years. And when this book, it became clear that it's time to write this book, I decided to go ahead and play with that and see, where do the words want to be on the page? Mm-hmm. How do I want to break the words here? How do I make it so that the cadence of the word matches the looks of the look of the words. And I fully expected to have to strip all of that out and make it look like a regular book. But I was lucky enough in that, you know what, the feedback that I got from readers was very clear and adamant. No, you've got to keep it this way. It's part of the book. It's part of the story. Somehow, this gives you some kind of feel to the book that you would lose if you stripped out that formatting. So that's where it came from. Mm. And I'm actually delighted with it. I really, really like how it invites you into the page more so than other books.
I think it draws you into the characters even more because they have defined positions on the page.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
I really like that. It's and I'd be honest with you, from my perspective as a person who is very nearsighted and has to use a magnifying glass to read most things, it makes it much easier to follow as well as read and then pick up where I left off, from the last time. And of course, having been in this business in radio and broadcasting for so many years, as I'm reading to my wife, I find myself, you know, sort of taking on the momentary persona of the character in that particular dialogue passage, and then shifting to, say, the seeker, who might be a little less sure, a little nervous, a little uneasy and frustrated and so forth, and that kind of comes out as well. So it makes for a good read. And again, as I said, we're really looking forward to delving deeper into it. And I encourage our listeners to grab a copy. You can also go to the website, theholyuniverse.com. And that holy is H-O-L-Y. So it's the holy, H-O-L-Y, universe.com. There's all kinds of neat stuff up on the website there as well. And I'm wondering, have you plans on turning this into an audio book?
I've been asked that many times, and I have no immediate plans, but it's certainly part of what I would love to do. I'd love to turn it into an audiobook. I'm not quite as excited about turning it into an electronic book because I don't know how the format will translate over onto the formats.
I think the only way that that's going to hold is in a PDF format, but then you can't really.
Yeah, and but anyhow, there are ways of going about that too.
Sure.
So there's part of me that would, you know, if I had my druthers, I think I'd love to do the audiobook before I did the electronic book, but both of them, I think, eventually will certainly happen. And there's something about holding a physical book in the page, in your hands, too, and having the physical page right there in your hands. I really like that.
Makes a big difference. I'll be honest with you. It really does. I've tried reading, and I have a few books on my smartphone that they're PDF files or what have you. And I can struggle through them. I certainly can make the text as large as I want to. But I just love having the capabilities of just holding the book and going for, and I really feel like I'm accomplishing something when I'm done with that read for the day. I can see where I am, where the bookmark is. And I say, okay, I've gone this far and I have all this much further to go, but boy, I can hardly wait to get there.
Yes.
Whereas it used to be, God, I can hardly wait to finish this book. This is just going on forever. But it's the books, it's the material, it's what we choose to read. And I talk about this it's in a book I'm working on about choices in terms of the input that we take in, that which we take in through our eyes and our ears and so forth, what we read, what we see, what we hear, what we taste, smell, the people that we associate with, the places that we go, all of that. And so when it comes to things of this nature, I'm just really it's just a lot of fun, I have to tell you. It's really opened up, I think, an old world for me that I wish had been open when I was growing up, because I feel like on the one hand, I've missed out on so much. I have not read a lot of the great classics, even of my time, let alone of days gone by. And so it's hard for me to converse about that or even have those concepts in my mind. But nonetheless, it takes me to a place where I worked for 15 years at a Christian radio station. So, David, I know the creation story, okay? I got that down pat. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and so forth and so on, and infinitum. And now you come along with a new story of creation.
Yes.
And as far as I know, there are only two. And one is the creation story, and the other is evolution, as far as creation. And I, after learning about both, I took the position that I believed in both of them, because I believe God created evolution. You know, that's where I was many years ago. Mm-hmm. So give us, how does a man, a former airline pilot, take on the task of, so to speak, I'm gonna use this term, you correct me, of rewriting the creation story? I mean, isn't that a little blasphemous?
Well, when my first writing coach and I came up with the title, or I came up with the title, there was a certain point when I'm thinking of that particular part of the book where it talks about the beginning of all beginnings, and that, just to take a little side trip on that, when I wrote that, I stopped, put my pencil down, and thought, where did this come from? because it sure, I certainly didn't have the idea of the persona, or I didn't have the persona of a writer in mind for most of my adult life. And certainly, even after I started writing the book, I'm still getting used to the idea. But at any rate, it is rather audacious. And we were talking about that particular passage, you know, the beginning of all beginnings, a time of no time. And it very much echoes that, the creation story that is in Genesis 1 and 2. And I told him, you know, some people might have a bit of a problem with this. And he just kind of smiled and he said, David, if you're not making someone angry, you're not trying hard enough. Or you're censoring yourself too much. So, you know, write what comes through you. And some people will love it. Some people will hate it. And if that's the case, you probably have done your job. So, but as far as where it came from, where my own background came from, I grew up in the Episcopal Church. So part of what I think I had something of a similar to yours in that, you know, I had been inculcated in this idea of the Bible being the story, and not quite as I didn't grow up in an evangelical church, so it wasn't quite as clear that the Bible is infallible and is the only source. But it certainly was very, very important. And yet, as you discovered too, when you look at evolution, even if you believe God uses evolution, after a while, it still doesn't quite fit with what the, not so much what the scriptures say, but it's the story about the scriptures that becomes in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, there we are with that whole theme of story again. So at a certain point, I did leave that story behind, but... And I really love the way the new story was told by a gentleman named Tom. I think he might have actually been a Catholic. He was a Catholic theologian, Thomas Berry. Brian Swim is a mathematical cosmologist. And Elizabeth Sartorius is a biologist. And all these people were talking about this new story and looking at the creation of the universe from a scientific standpoint, but in a different way of leaving behind that old mechanistic, meaningless story behind and looking at the universe that seems to be very, very clear on what it wants to do. It's so many things over the evolution of the universe have been timed so perfectly, have been adjusted so perfectly. If the expansion of the universe was just a little bit slower, the universe would have collapsed back in on itself. If the expansion was a little bit, just even a tiny fraction, millionth, billionth of a second slower, faster, the universe would spin out and dissipating and never would have created any of that of what we see beforehand. There are so many things that are so finely tuned that this certainly is a creative universe. And how intentional that is part of the ultimate mystery. Anyhow, I really love that story. And I love hearing especially Brian Swim tell that story. He's just so amazed by everything. And that infected me. But there was a part of me that wanted more, because I really missed, even though I didn't miss the interpretation of the Bible, I really missed the sound and the cadence of the scriptures and the lyricism of the liturgy. I missed all of that. And a lot of the work that's out there in the new story is done in a nonfiction or even academic settings. And there's part of me that missed the poetry, that missed the metaphor, that really missed the heart and soul of the story. So that's how I finally came with the encouragement of my first writing coach. That's how I came to be that, no, you should write this story. You know this material well enough. Go ahead and write your part of the story and let's see what happens. And the book is what the result is of that initial effort.
Well, I think that people are going to be quite surprised and intrigued as well, and entertained as well. As we were talking earlier about actually holding a physical book, but just the process of reading, and I've actually likened it to deciphering a code, because that's what this is. You're looking at symbols on a page, and you're turning them into audible words or sounds. Which is also part of the creation story, if you will. And those sounds also will then generate in the mind of a man, of humanity, if we want to use the broader term, images, pictures. So there have been some books that I have read that I've got a movie running in my head while I'm reading this book. Mm-hmm. And so I'm real excited to see your movie in my head in the not too distant future. But I find that because I remember reading, for example, Dan Brown's two books, Angels and Demons and, of course, The Da Vinci Code. And there was no movie in the works as far as I knew at that time. I didn't know who was going to play the lead character. But what was so bizarre was Hanks looked like the very character in my movie, in my head. That's what was really intriguing. And that happens to me a lot more than it doesn't, which kind of goes back to one of the things that you were talking about, how you said it initially, of course, you didn't believe in, channeling and those kinds of things. And yet, what other explanation could you have for much of what has transpired and is now on the page? Then something akin to that. I mean, there was some higher inspiration, shall we say, that has led you?
Yeah, there was some. Let me see what comes in the silence about that question.
Okay. I'll let you be silent while let our listeners know. The book we're talking about is The Holy Universe. It is a new story of creation for the heart, soul, and spirit. And theholyuniverse.com is the website you can go to. David Christopher is my guest. And we're talking about, of course, as with all these programs, we talk about all kinds of different things in addition to the works. And I have to say, David, that we don't usually spend that much time talking about the book itself, because I want to find out more about you and where you're coming from and so forth, and where you feel you're going to, because people can pick up the book and read that anytime. They don't always get the opportunity to get to know the author of a particular work or the creator of a particular piece of material and what have you. But I just feel like, the direction that we've taken here is extremely important, and so forth.
And I've got some of the feedback that I've gotten. I've actually heard more than one person say a rather surprising thing, that it's like you've taken all these things that have been flying in my head and assembled them into one particular place.
Well,
the book does range over an enormous. Sometimes I look at it and I think, my goodness, where in the world did this come from? So, and getting back to your original question, I think part of me feels that that there is, I think Jung was onto something when he talked about a collective consciousness, that there is something more. We are, if we are deeply connected from since the very beginning of the universe, 13.8 billion years ago, then there's probably much more than in how we are connected than just through physical means. I mean, I'm looking at the trees outside right now, and I'm connected to them directly because I give them carbon dioxide and they give me oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so there is a relationship there. You cannot draw a picture of a human being by themselves without drawing everything else that that human being relies on. And then everything else that those species rely on. And yeah. then all the mechanical, the physical processes of seasons, of orbits, of galaxies. You have to have all that or you have an incomplete picture.
Yeah.
So there's, if that's the case, it seems that there have to be other realms, other ways of being in the universe that science is very, very skeptical of. And I tend to be very skeptical of until I really start to think about it, that, you know, it just seems to make sense that this particular story, this book, comes out at a time where a lot of people, whether it's coincidence or where it's serendipity, it seems like there's an interest in this message. There's an interest in let's overcome this old story of we're separate beings. It's a mechanical universe. Our job is to consume and simply be happy. That story just simply isn't going to work anymore.
It's not serving us anymore.
Well, it certainly isn't serving us anymore. And so I do feel like when I am writing and kind of going back to one of the things you mentioned too, as far as how we create symbols out of words or we decode.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the fun of this book was finding the right word. And, you know, I think it's Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, who said the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. And, you know, not to say that there aren't a lot of lightning bugs in my piece, because I'm sure there are, but it was fun. It was so wonderful such a wonderful part of the creative process to have these lightning bolts hit of, oh, here's the word that belongs here. That's the way to say it. And that, to me, part of it, it's a mysterious place where that comes from. I really don't know where it comes from. All I know is that it's fun and enjoyable, and you start to lose track of time when you're in the groove of actually putting together a particular passage in the book.
Well, speaking of words, which your book is made up of, fortunately, not a bunch of pictures. I was reading the introduction to my wife, and I'm actually scanning the introduction now to see if I can find the word that there were two words that I came across, and I actually had to look them up because I had never heard or seen them before. I also wanted to know if I was pronouncing them correctly, and I was not.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to waste a great deal of time trying to find the words. One of them was, if I can remember the spelling, I think it was E-N-N-U-I.
Ennui.
Ennui.
Yes.
And then there was another word that looked like it had been created from another word, I want to say modity. I don't think I have that pronounced correctly. But it's also in the introduction.
Oh, modernity.
Thank you, modernity.
Yes, modernity.
I had never heard of, I'd heard of ennui before. But I wasn't sure of the definition. I had never heard of pronounce it one more time.
Ennui.
No, the other one. The other one.
I believe it's it's a French.
French.
Word,
yes, it
it's
is.
A French origin, and basically, it's a sense of disconnection, a sense of. And this is my definition.
Mm-hmm.
You may get some email from some of your readers who are much more well-versed in English than I am. The English majors may come and correct me, which is thank God for the English majors. But for me, it was this sense of is this really all this is all about? This is about. And way back when, I remember one of my first jobs out of school, even before I was in Silicon Valley, I was pulling out of a fast food parking lot onto this one of those boulevards that is just full of strip mall after strip mall after strip mall for miles and miles. And there was a sense of there's something deeply important that is missing from this. There's something very, very stark about what we've created with our physical environment. And for me, the ennui that I was feeling was that sense of disconnection. It was that sense of separation in that old story that I had. And, you know, as this particular passage says, you know, even though I still carry old wounds and concerns and I still have my own, how am I going to get past this next milestone that I need to get past, that I want to get past? I no longer have that sense of ennui, that sense of alienation, that sense of being lost in a meaningless universe. That is no longer there. My life doesn't necessarily flow as any better than it did before. And in a lot of ways it does, but I think it's important to know. And I think is an important point, is that once a person starts to discover that sense of connection, you don't have to berate yourself if your life still has the challenges that many of our modern lives have. I mean, we still have to provide for our day-to-day needs. We still have a lot of things that we need to pay attention to. So part of my own spiritual work with this book has been, how do I deal with those day-to-day concerns and issues and conflicts and whatnot with a little bit more lightheartedness and with a little bit more gratitude? And that has started to happen, and that's very much a blessing that, you know, even if this book didn't go any forward, for my own selfish, didn't go anywhere beyond this, for my own selfish reasons, it actually has fulfilled, it has certainly fulfilled a purpose in that way.
And the other word, of course, modernity, having to do with things of the modern time, if you will.
Yeah, the modern mind. Yeah.
The modern mind, in that respect, especially. But see, that's to me that one of the there are two. There's a couple of things I like in regards to reading. Yeah, it can be frustrating when I come across a word and I cannot pronounce it to save my life. So I've got to look it up, and thank God for the Merriam-Webster's app that will actually pronounce it for me. Uh-huh. And it's along the same lines as watching a movie, and the ending is not anything close to what you thought it would be. It's not part of the formula of films. Mm-hmm. It ends in a way, and I think the first one of the first movies that I saw like that was, I believe it was called Midnight in Paris by Woody Allen. I mean, you figure, okay, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, end of story.
We know where this is going, right?
Yeah. I did not see that ending coming. I mean, and it was, I loved it. It was fabulous. So when I'm looking at these words, and my wife she loves words. She carries around with her in her purse a pocket. I don't know how you can have a pocket Oxford dictionary, but that she carries around with her, and she'll look up a word, and if she comes across something, or she'll just look up a word to have a word for the day of her own. I don't know of many people that do that, that are that interested in understanding. And it's like, I forget what the statistic is exactly, but I think that 100 years ago, our vocabulary list of words that we used was like 80 or 90,000. Today, I don't think it's over 20, maybe 30,000.
I had not heard that.
Yeah. I mean, we're just and of course, people are creating new words that mean something that there's already a word for. And I'm thinking, I don't get it, other than, you know, it's now a modern slang word for that thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I still remember Stephen Colbert coming up with truthiness. And I'm going, what? And now it's in the dictionary, which I was shocked.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, words are What was it you said earlier about words, that they're great and descriptive, but they also miss the mark?
Well, they are symbols. They are symbols for the object. When I say window, that isn't the word window is not a window. The window itself is the window.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so. And yet we start to think that, and we start. That's the danger of language, is you start getting almost too abstract.
Well, one of the
that coupled with technology is very powerful and very dangerous. I mean, one of the points that Sage brings out at a certain point in the book is that technology can act as a separator from the consequences of our actions. And so I can fill up the tank in my car and not see all the oil fields and the rainforest that have been leveled to create, for instance, in China. China is trying to go after Ecuador's oil and Canada's oil. And you don't have to see that. When I throw something away, I don't see the effects of the plastic as it breaks down and travels out to the ocean and starts to raise havoc with marine life. So, you know, the abstraction coupled with such a powerful technology, without waking up, that is going to cause a lot of problems for us. On the other side of it is that it may be possible that the technology will help us with this awakening. I actually can see, due to technology, I can see some of the effects of what's going on in the rainforest. One of the volunteer organizations that I've fallen in love with is called the Pachamama Alliance. And that's the work that they do, is doing rainforest preservation work with the indigenous peoples of Ecuador and also in Peru, and some, and they're actually expanding out into Brazil. So that technology allows me to see what's going on down there. That technology also allows them to learn about the ways of modern mind so that they can bring their cause to modern mind in that worldview. One of the ideas of you can own a piece of land is completely foreign to some cultures of ancient mind. It's like, how in the world can you say you own this parcel of land and no one else can go on it? I mean, you have territory. That's one thing.
Sure.
The range of my territory where I hunt, fish, eat, sleep, and whatnot. But to say that you own it and then you can sell it to someone else, it's completely foreign. And
yeah,
that's part of what the Pachamama Alliance's work has been, is to teach them these concepts and to teach them these ideas, the ways of the modern world, and the words that we use in order to describe ourselves and to describe humanity, so that they can then understand and actually be effective in protecting their lands and their ways of life.
Well, what I find so interesting, and this goes back to my my 15 years, I'm not even sure how to describe it anymore. It was the greatest education I was ever paid for, working for a Christian radio station. But but one of the things that I learned about had to do with the Hebrew language. And actually, I learned it from another source, and it's what made me start to question the stories that I was being told from the book that was supposed to be the source of all information and knowledge. And that was that because the Old Testament was written from the Hebrew, each letter has its own legend, tone, vibration, numerical rating, even story that goes with that letter. Then you start putting the letters together into words, and it creates a whole new legend. And those words go together in sentences, and you create a new one, and on and on and on. Then when you translate that into another language, it's all gone.
You lose a lot of it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this with Greg Braden in terms of some of the things that we've discussed. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people do find that language is almost – can also almost be perceived as sort of an inhibitor to the ability to connect with one another because we don't understand the imagery.
Yes, yes, yes. And I actually, an interesting thing too, is that I tend to be a very analytical person, and I tend to be very much, you know, as people, I've been told, you're very much in your head. And that's where, you know, metaphorically speaking, that's where language is. It's in our, you know, it's for me, it seems like it's really in my head. And the wonderful thing about poetry, was it Ursula Le Guin who said, poetry is saying in words what can't be said in words. And that's the wonderful thing about poetry, is that a really good poem, and I think everyone is capable of writing good poetry, it works well because it comes from a different source, and it relies not just on the meaning, the abstract meaning of the word, but it's also the sound of the word and the look of the word and what that word means in when it's juxtaposed with other words and put together in ways that you don't expect them to be put together. There's a particular passage that was wonderful that came, another passage that came to me, that it talks, and it gets back to the idea of catastrophe. And at one point, the web of life was in deep catastrophe because we as life beings learned how to create photosynthesis and draw energy from the sun. And this particular passage came to me. It said, once again, catastrophe struck the web of life. For as the beings who seized starlight to strip apart water and air became stronger and multiplied, they gave off oxygen, a vile and poisonous fire that slowly spread and turned the color of the sky an ominous, deadly blue. And that was another point where I've set my pencil down and said, my goodness, when did the color of this gorgeous blue sky I'm looking at right now, when did that color become a poison? And that's what happened early on. Mm. It was a catastrophe. Oxygen was an absolute catastrophe to early life. But we found a way. Life found a way to use oxygen as a powerful source of fuel rather than as something that was poisonous and dangerous.
And then we turned that into a fuel for the others, for the plants mm-hmm. and the trees
yes.
and so
yeah.
forth.
And it's an amazing, it's fun that I get to stop and play with a story almost every day. And it's a wonderful way of stopping and looking around at all the life that's around me. Even in the middle of a strip mall, there's a little tiny weed there saying, I'm going to give it a shot here and see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how tenacious life is. It's amazing how much the universe is tuned toward life and wants it. It acts as if it wants life. It just has to have it. Hmm. And who knows where that craving comes from.
It's
part of the delightful mystery as far as I'm concerned.
And I heard something very interesting. I was watching a movie that's about a center up in Northern California. Actually, it's north of Sacramento. And of course, it's pretty much self-sustaining. And one of the things that they do there is they don't plan out, okay, well, what are we going to plant here and what are we going to grow here?
Mm-hmm.
They ask the earth, what do you want us to plant here? They ask the trees, you know, what do you – and it, that may sound to some, well, that's kind of silly. You don't ask the plants or the earth, but it comes in the same way that your book came in. Through that mm-hmm. inspiration, if you will, through that still small voice, whatever the case may be. And I think that that's part of where we've really missed the mark as humanity, in that we've stopped listening, let alone heeding and following through with the guidance. We just flat out have stopped listening, and we found lots of ways to distract ourselves from hearing the voice.
Yes, and I've, you know, this is not the first time I've heard a story like that, where you know where a person grows quiet and learn and hears, where should we plant?
Yeah.
What wants to happen here? And again, hearkening back to the airline pilot, there's a part of me that says, no, come on. But there, I've come across enough stories to say, you know, why wouldn't this be a possibility? Why couldn't it? Maybe we don't have the strict scientific evidence that's repeatable in a very strict scientific way, but science has its limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And we might do well to, you know, before we have that scientific discovery, to allow that possibility to be there. And it's interesting, you know, as you were talking, there is a part of the dialogue where the sage talks about is, you know, asking the seekers to consider how each species might have its own collective consciousness, and that we are a young species, that plants, which are hundreds of millions of years older than us, might have learned much in their own evolution and might have much to teach us. Now, the seeker blanches at that idea, but there's a part of me that wonders that, I am certainly wide open to that possibility. And I think that becoming more open to that possibility can only help us become more connected with that to that which created us.
I matter of fact, to that last statement that you made, just the last few words, I used to tell people here we are on this planet, and we didn't create ourselves, as far as I know. We didn't, but I don't know. I mean, if we all came from the oneness, and the oneness is what created us, well, then I guess you could logically surmise that we did.
Well, yes. In fact, Brian Swim uses the term that he uses a phrase that says, we are the universe in the form of a human being.
Is this a take on Michael Jackson's We Are the World?
I think he had a different person in mind, but yeah, we can go with that. Certainly.
Well, I have really enjoyed our conversation here today, and I'm looking forward to having you back on the program in the near future as well. But before we wrap up the program, I need to ask you a couple more questions. Who is David Christopher?
Who is David Christopher? David Christopher, well, that is a name given to an entity who is trying to figure out his place on the planet, who is part of an evolutionary process that has within it the old part of the brain that really cares about fight, flight, feed, freeze, and procreate. There's that strong part of me there, and it's very insistent, and it's very strong, and it's strong in all of us to continue. And then there are other parts of me that were created through evolution, what's called the mammalian brain, and then what Michael Dowd has this wonderful term he calls the monkey mind, which he borrowed from other places. But there's a part of me that's the prefrontal cortex, which Michael Dowd calls the higher porpoise, to make it easy to remember. That brain, and then that rest of the nervous system that's also within my gut and also scattered throughout my body, because I don't think we're just our brains. That whole interaction with this world that we claim is the so-called outside world brings forth a certain personality that, if you have a couple more hours, we can talk more about who David Christopher is.
Okay. And quite honestly, there's no right answer. That's the beautiful thing about these kinds of programs. There's no right answer to any of these questions. If you want to select AAA, BBB, CCC, go right ahead. So let me ask you, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
My hope certainly is that to help forward this idea, this new story, to really give my purpose in writing the book was twofold. Well, it's probably manifold, but one of the purposes was certainly to explain the world and the universe to myself. And that it is certainly done. I really feel I have it to give me a story that sounded like the stories I grew up with, that has both, that is both true and friendly to the science, but is also true and friendly to my heart and my soul and my spirit. It's also true to my gut too. So, and my hope is that other people find it useful too, that it tells the story about where we came from and how we got here and how we also got into all these predicaments that we're in right now, as far as in terms of the ecology of the planet, in terms of social justice, how do we equitably share the bounty of the web of life, and in terms of spirituality, especially in cultures like ours that really deny that. That don't think that spirituality is that important. It's much more important. You watch television and you can see what we think is important. It's not spirituality. So part of my hope is that it begins to bring forth something, a story that goes well beyond that, as the sage calls it, the story of planetary mind, which sees us as connected. It sees us as part of a process that is both destructive and creative. And that our job is, you know, we've learned much, but there's still far much for us to learn as this planetary mind awakens within this universe.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Well, collectively, we're changing the planet. Collectively, we are now entering what some scientists are calling the Anthropocene. We've been in the Holocene for the past, oh, I don't know how many years. One of your listeners who's a geologist will be able to help me out. I'm going to wage a wild guess and say somewhere between 10 and 50,000 years. We've been in the Holocene, which has been actually the past 10,000 years has actually been a very stable climate, remarkably stable climate on Earth. So, this humanity makes an enormous difference. And if we, and individually, I think we can also make an enormous difference because the stories come from somewhere. We create the stories and we perpetuate the stories through our cultures. And whether or not a small handful of people can change the larger story remains to be seen. Margaret Mead certainly seems to believe so with her quote, that is the only way that that change has occurred, is through small groups of people.
Yeah.
And, well, there's an interesting metaphor. As a caterpillar turns into a butterfly, as it enters the chrysalis stage, there are cells that emerge within the caterpillar called imaginal cells that have the idea of what the caterpillar will become in the future. And the interesting thing is that the immune system of the caterpillar sees it as sees these imaginal cells as foreign entities and starts to attack them. Hmm. But as these imaginal cells find one another and link up, they start to take over the genetic future of the caterpillar and create the chrysalis and create the butterfly. So I think that's a wonderful metaphor of what we may be going through now, is as individuals begin to wake up and begin to link up, I think it's quite possible that we can change the larger story. We'll see how soon it happens and we'll see what we make of it. But certainly it's a fascinating concept and a fascinating time to be alive in.
Well, it's a story for the ages. It is called the Holy Universe. And it is a new story of creation for the heart, soul, and spirit. My guest has been David Christopher. And David, I want to thank you for taking so much time with us. This has been great, and I do look forward to having you back again, and we can talk more about our connectedness to one another and to the rest of the universe at large. And hopefully, with the next time we talk, we will maybe have seen some interesting changes in our world for the betterment of humanity.
That would be wonderful, and I'd look forward to another chance to talk. Thank you so much.
Great. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Once again, the website is theholyuniverse.com. That's H-O-L-Y, theholyuniverse.com. Again, the book by the same name, without the .com, A New Story of Creation for the Heart, Soul, and Spirit. And if you're listening to the radio program, there's more. And if you're listening to A to Z, Zen.fm's interview, there is more. Stay with us. I'm Richard Dugan, and we look forward to talking with you again next time. And until then, love to Lal.